Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast.
Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts Amelia
and Beth.
And today we are talking about something really cool and interesting.
Of course. We're doing the big L this week, or the big L's.
Big L's.
The big L's. For
libraries and lighthouses.
And we're going to talk about haunted libraries and lighthouses.
Yes.
Which just, I guess is three of my favorite things.
Describe them. Like it's.
Well, we'll describe them a little, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, there has to be a ghost, or we don't talk about it on the show.
That's true. Although last week we talked about monsters, which I thought was great fun.
There were some ghosts thrown in there.
Yeah, but mainly it was monsters, and I was kind of happy with that.
Woohoo.
Yeah.
Okay.
I made Amelia do all the work this week, though.
No. So we're not just talking about libraries and lighthouses, because that would be very broad. We are talking about libraries and lighthouses in Boston and Connecticut.
That was kind of an accident. Apparently, I was supposed to do Connecticut, and I ended up with Boston instead.
It's okay. It just gives us more stories to tell the people. It's okay. Okay.
I'm not very good at following directions.
It's all right. Okay. So, Beth, I'm going to begin tonight's tales with the Deep River Library.
Ooh.
It kind of just sounds haunted.
It sounds like it's probably right by a lighthouse, too.
Probably.
Yeah.
At very least by a deep river.
Oh, at the very, very least.
Yeah. Since the 1950s, the library has experienced paranormal activity that includes early morning noises and voices that ask question after question in about 20-second intervals. What is your name? What year is it? What am I doing here? These questions can also be followed by flashes of light. The building was built to be a magnificent home in 1881 by Richard Pratt Spencer. Now, never trust a man with two first names. A local and prominent businessman, Spencer lived in the home with his second wife and three children until he passed away.
Wait, he's got two first names and two wives?
Two for two.
Look at that. Sorry. I'll try not to interrupt too much.
It's okay. Until he passed away at 90 years old in the year 1910. The mansion had exceptionally beautiful fireplaces, refined woodwork, and elegant touches. When Spencer's widow, Julia, died in 1932, his son sold the home to the Staybrook Library Association, which I would kind of like to point something out. So this guy dies in 1910. He's 90 years old, right? Extremely old for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then his wife dies in 1932. So it's 22 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go out on a limb and assume she probably wasn't also 90, just due to the time period. So not only did he have a second wife, he had like a hot young second wife.
Possibly.
Unless she's like the oldest woman of the 1930s.
Well, you're assuming that she was a hot wife. She might have just been like a homely wife that he owed the father a favor here.
That's true.
I'll take this girl off your hands and you'll give me, you know, a farm and six goats.
A mansion.
It happens.
Is it a mansion?
A mansion near a deep river. And some goats.
Okay. So his son sold it to the Saybrook Library Association and they turned it into a library. And they didn't have to pay that much for it. He sold it pretty cheap because he wanted it to be a library. Not much renovations had been done until 1995, when a children's addition was built. In 2004, a paranormal investigator asked the library's director, Ann Piatta, for an after-hours tour of the library, and the director said yes. While on the main floor near the original stove, the investigator felt the presence of two female spirits.
Were their names Amelia and Beth?
No. Oh, maybe. I have no idea. So since that experience, Pieta has received dozens of requests for paranormal investigations from all over the Northeast. In 2010, the Hartford Courant ran an article about the haunted library, piquing the public's interest once again. More than 30 private investigations involving more than 20 paranormal groups have taken place at the library. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Most groups have recorded electronic voice phenomena or have captured photos and videos, while for a few, there was no activity at all. Most groups said that they have never felt anything evil. In September 2012, two staff members...
Hang on. They have never felt anything evil in that library, or they have never felt anything evil ever in their lives?
In the library.
Okay. So I didn't get that from what you said. Most groups said they have never felt anything evil.
In the library.
Okay, in the library.
We good? Can I continue?
Yes, yeah, sorry.
Okay. In September 2012, two staff members heard a child's laughter. No one was there. After hours, staffers have heard talking and have smelled cigar smoke. Both patrons and staff have seen a woman floating down the stairs and looking out an upstairs window. One evening around midnight during an investigation, it appeared as though there was a party going on upstairs. Deep River Public Library was featured in the June 2011 debut of the Sci-Fi Channel's Haunted Collector, in which the show's investigators saw among the library's shelves the figure of a woman who was thought to be Julia Spencer, Richard Spencer's widow, as we heard about before. His may or may not be hot, but definitely younger second wife.
She might have lived to 110.
I don't think so. Maybe. The library has held a few fundraisers tied to the ghost theme, such as Spirits with the Spirits. The library also hosted well-attended paranormal lectures with groups presenting evidence they captured at the library and at other locations. Which, we went to a talk like that one time at a library about the Fairbanks house.
Mm-hmm.
So, that is my story of the Deep River Library. I should have, because we're talking about libraries, and I feel like one of these librarians is going to hear this and like expect us to have all of our references. But one that I did read a lot of was on the American Libraries Magazine's website. And this library director actually wrote an article, and it is incredibly well written.
That was a good story, Amelia.
Thanks.
Which part did you find the spookiest about it?
I find children's voices very scary because I have heard children's voices a lot and have conducted investigations with Tenny Kumar, who says that whenever you hear a child's voice, she thinks it's really a demon in disguise.
That's horrible.
Yep. Sure is.
So by Tenny's logic, there are demons in your library.
In this library, yeah.
The library in your story.
In the story, yeah.
Okay.
I don't have a library.
Do you want to hear about my library now?
Yes.
So among the many amazing establishments that the founding fathers of the United States set the stage for, none are quite as widely used and widely misunderstood as libraries. The idea of a free public library was unknown before revolutionary America. And before that, libraries were private collections, usually owned by wealthy men who would hoard books in their fancy reading rooms as a way to demonstrate their considerable wealth. Or colleges would have vast libraries accessible to the wealthy students who attended the school. Membership libraries had been in existence from as far ago as 2000 BC in what we now call Egypt. Basically, to become a member, you had to buy shares or pay a membership fee. Then you had access to the library as a social club. Read, debate, catch up with friends, have a coffee. There was no tea in revolutionary America. That would have been unpatriotic. Libraries were gathering places for the intellectual class of the 1700s and 1800s. In 1833, Peterborough, New Hampshire, accidentally opened the first free public library. And when the funds ran out, they passed a law in 1849 to fund the library with tax dollars. So that's just a quick history of public libraries. Boston built a small independent social library on Congress Street in 1807. The Boston The Boston Athenaeum was focused on local literature and New England history. By 1849, it outgrew the small building and was moved to the current location on Beacon Street, directly across from the Massachusetts State House and overlooking the Granary Burying Ground. By 1951, it was considered one of the largest libraries in the United States. It has five floors packed full of books. Books, books. It's just such a wonderful idea of five full floors of books. So before we get to the ghost story, and I promise there is a ghost story, I want to talk about a really, really creepy book that is owned by the Boston Athenaeum. It's called The Skin Book.
Yep. I know about this.
Have you seen it?
I have not seen it, but I do know about it.
Okay. Well, maybe someday we'll go and see it. In 1809, the world saw the birth of James Allen in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Oh, somebody else with two first names here, Amelia.
Hmm.
James Allen was the type of kid who wouldn't have been caught dead in the library, and you'll appreciate the irony in a moment. By 15 years old, he was a career criminal. He was in and out of jails and prisons for various crimes. He had a slew of aliases, including Jonas Pierce, James York, Burley Grove, and George Walton. Robbery was his favorite crime, and he was a widely known highwayman. In the course of his jail stays and his robbering lifestyle, he caught tuberculosis. Check out our episode a few weeks ago for details on tuberculosis in the U.S. during the 1800s and 1900s. As James Allen lay dying on his bunk, he asked the prison warden to take his confession and write his life story. The prison warden wrote James' life story in approximately 40 pages and then heard James' unusual demand. James wanted the text bound in his own skin. And so it shall be. When James died a few days later, a large part of the skin on his back was removed and sent to a tannery to be dried and stretched, or whatever they do to animal skin to make it leathery. Then the skin was sent to a publisher who bound the pages with James Allen's skin. In some locations, I heard there were two books created, and in other sources, they indicate one book was made. The book now belongs to the Boston Athenaeum, but no one's really sure how it got there. The most common explanation is that James Allen bequeathed a copy, or the copy, to John Fenno. James Allen contended that in all his robbering ways, John Fenno was the only man who ever stood up to him or fought back when James was robbing them. And the story is that John Fenno and his descendants used the book as a paddle to punish naughty children. One of the Fenno descendants turned the book over to the Boston Athenaeum, where you can see it today. And now, the ghost.
Hold on. What the heck kind of gift is that, though?
What do you mean?
Like, is it, I don't know how I would react if someone sent me that kind of gift. Like, I am, in parts of my life, known for standing up for myself to the point where I get in a lot of trouble for it. And if one of those people was like, "Dear Miss Amelia, you stood up to me one time when I was being rather crass. Here's a book bound in my skin." I'd be like, huh. You can give me some money or something. Like, yeah.
I mean, the guy didn't have any money to give out or anything, but somebody had to have paid to have that book made. Well, I'm sure that the tannery guy didn't.
But
do
like,
it for
what
free.
Kind of message is that? Is that like a wow? You were a great guy.
It's a really weird message.
That's what I'm saying. Like, what would you do
if somebody sent me a book made out of their own skin?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I would change my name and move away.
But why? They can't find you. They're dead.
I don't want whatever like bad energy they have sent my way.
Yes, like, that was the next thing I was gonna say. Is it bad energy?
I mean, I don't know. I think if somebody sent me that book, I don't think that I would call the Boston Athenaeum and offer to give it to them. But maybe.
Also, that is also a good point. Like, why do you call? Why did that person get it and be like, "Oh, I'm going to call it a library, or I'm going to call it a museum"? You know, in essence, that's kind of what they did. Like, why?
Well, I mean, that part I understand actually much better. That how many books do you know of that are covered in human skin?
None. I don't read.
So now the Boston Athenaeum has one.
I read an article online that there's this place up in Canada where you can drink a shot of whiskey that has a mummified toe in it.
I don't exactly know
how that's related. I meant to send that to you.
That's disturbing. I'm not entirely sure what to say about that.
I'm a little interested in their health codes up there.
Where did they get a mummified toe? Why did someone think that was a good idea? Exactly how much whiskey did they have to drink first before they thought of this?
Over 1,900 people have had the drink.
No, thank
you. It's the same toe in every one.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, the other part is...
Actually, I don't know if it's the same toe in every one. I might have made that part up, but I can't imagine they have 1,900 toes hanging around.
It's been a long time since I was a drinker. And even then, I wasn't like a shots person. But if it's in the glass, aren't you supposed to eat it?
I don't know.
So, I mean, that's the other disturbing part. I mean, like, if you somebody correct me on that one who's a little bit more learned in the ways of the liquor shots. But, yeah, I would think, like, I mean, if you have a – I mean, if what am I thinking of? If you have, like, a martini and there's an olive in it, like – and it's on a toothpick, you're allowed to eat it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if it's not on a toothpick? Are you not allowed to eat it?
I know that my brother used to work at a Mexican restaurant and he would eat the worm.
Out of other people's drinks?
No, out of his. They'd pour him a tequila shot with the worm in it. That's when he lived in Nebraska.
Isn't the worm made of, like, soaked in mescaline?
I don't know.
Anyway, so there's a book in a library in Boston that's made out of a guy's skin.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can actually go see it. And I'll give you some details on that at the end. But first, I wanted to talk about the ghost.
Okay.
So for those of you familiar with the storied history of the Salem witch trials, and no, I'm not giving you that whole history here, you may recall that one of the judges was named Hawthorne. And Judge Hawthorne was cursed by one of the women condemned for being a witch. And so then when Hawthorne's great-grandson, Nathaniel Hawthorne, yes, the one from the Scarlet Letter and the House of Seven Gables, enters the story, you know you're going to have some weird stuff happen. Nathaniel was a member of the Boston Athenaeum at the original location on Congress Street. He would spend hours there each day engaging in reading and socializing with his acquaintances. On April 4th, 1842, Nathaniel walked into the Athenaeum and saw the longtime librarian, Reverend Thaddeus Mason Harris, sitting in his usual chair reading the Boston Post. Nathaniel gave a nonchalant greeting that wasn't returned and carried on with his day. And it wasn't until later that Nathaniel was told Reverend Harris died the previous day. Nathaniel couldn't believe this was true and went back to the Athenaeum the following morning to see Reverend Harris still sitting in that same chair, reading the Boston Post again. This goes on for several weeks. Nathaniel came to the conclusion that Reverend Harris was reading his own obituary and unable to believe that he was, in fact, dead. After several weeks of Reverend Harris appearing in the library after his death, although it's interesting to note Nathaniel never saw Reverend Harris enter or leave, he was just there.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. Was he ever like, "Hi, Reverend, how are you?"
Well, he gave him like that nonchalant greeting, but it wasn't returned. And yeah, it seems like there was no interaction between them. Reverend Harris reportedly looked right up at Nathaniel and made eye contact. Nathaniel wrote, "I remember. Once at least, and I know not but oftener, a sad, wistful, disappointed gaze, which the ghost fixed upon me from beneath his spectacles, a melancholy look of helplessness, which, if my heart had been as hard as a paving stone, I could hardly have withstood. But I did withstand it, and I think I saw him no more after this last appealing look. And with that sad look, Reverend Harris made his way into the afterlife. Or did he? The building moved from the Congress Street location to the Beacon Street location a few years after this encounter, but there are still reports of people seeing a ghostly figure at the new location. Seems Reverend Harris was very attached to his books, and he enjoys visiting them. Locals and tourists report seeing a man dressed in a pulpit robe standing in the hall outside the elevators waiting for a ride. There have also been consistent and unexplained problems with the elevator stalling, starting up, getting stuck, changing directions, and long periods of it just malfunctioning. The elevator is currently out of service, so the only person riding it these days is Reverend Harris on a leisurely afterlife tour of the resting place of all of his favorite books. You can visit the Boston Athenaeum at 10.5 Beacon Street in Boston, Massachusetts. There is an admission fee to enter. It's $10 for adults and kids over 13 to see the first floor, and $40 for a day pass to access all five floors. And if you think this is somewhere where you'd like to hang out a lot, you can buy an annual membership for between $310 and $525 for the year.
Quick question.
Okay.
Can you say that address again?
10.5 Beacon Street?
Yeah, 10.5.
Yeah.
I've never heard of a half address.
Oh, there's places like that in Boston. Because everything's all packed on top of each other.
In that movie I was telling you about being John Malkovich, he worked on the 13.5 floor, and it was like a half floor and everyone had to crouch down. It's a crazy movie, Beth. You should really watch it.
The building that I went to high school in, that actually is in the process of being demolished right now, had a weird thing like that as well, that there were like half floors. Like, I mean, none of them were like short, they were all normal height, but you would, so you'd be on like the main floor here and you go up like half a set of stairs and there'd be another floor here and then you go up another half a set of, and then, so it was like the floors were staggered left and right. It was weird. It was, apparently it won awards when they built it back in the 60s, but they actually had to demolish it because the way that it was built, there was no way for them to update it to make it ADA compliant, or it was built out of solid concrete. So in order to run any of the Wi-Fi, they had to drill holes through the walls, like just, you know, 18 inches of solid concrete. And like,
my high school was concrete too. It was created by some guy who does prisons.
Yeah, that was a really common thing. Then yeah. Was it built in the 60s?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Yeah, they were all built like that. Like, you've been over to UMass Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, other than, you know, all the nightmares that came from that, but do you know why it's built the way it is with no gathering places anywhere?
Mm-mm.
Because of all the protests that were happening about the Vietnam War. So a lot of the different the government buildings that were built, you know, schools, colleges and stuff, they were specifically designed not to have spaces where large groups of kids could gather to protest.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's one of those weird things that somehow infiltrated the rest of public life. Like, we don't want the kids to have anywhere that they can gather more than like 10 of them. So
I'm not sure. Sorry about
that. Oh, the half. Yeah. 10.5. Go to 10.5 Beacon Street. And so Boston Common is right there and the Massachusetts State House. And, it's a fun area to be in.
Okay. Great story. My next story is the Sheffield Island Lighthouse. Located less than a mile off the coast of Norwalk, Connecticut, Sheffield Island Lighthouse sits on a 53-acre island. The current tower and keeper's house were built in the year 1868, but the island has been a navigation point since the early 19th century. Sheffield Island, the westwardmost island in the Norwalk chain, rises out of a dangerous reef. In an effort to protect ships Entering the busy port, the U.S. government approved the island's owners with plans to construct a light warning passing ships of the hidden shoal. The island's residents gave their blessing, and in 1826, the first lighthouse was built. The Sheffield Island Lighthouse was deactivated in 1902. By 1914, it was purchased by Thorstein O'Stable. In 1986, it was purchased by the Norwalk Seaport Association, and they renovated and restored it so it could be used again. In 1989, the year I blessed the earth with my presence, the Sheffield...
My God, you weren't born until 1989?
Uh-uh.
I remember things happening in 1989, like, I don't
That's
know.
That's what Paul always says, too.
Like, third grade.
Yeah. In 1989, the Sheffield Island Lighthouse was placed in the National Register of Historic Places. By 1993, a generator was added to the lighthouse, but in the same year, a great storm caused the basement of the building, where some artifacts were stored, to be destroyed. It was operated again by 2002, and the Seaport Association already started a ferry service to the island, and it continues to be in business to this day. In 2011, the lighthouse was used again, and it was ran with solar-powered system. Today, the lighthouse is used only on the Norwalk side, but not for navigation purposes. A newspaper story in July 1872 announced that Noah Mosher, who had been the keeper since 1861, had died suddenly just a few days earlier. According to the story, Mosher was seated in his chair, spyglass in hand, watching several vessels which were passing by the island and talking about them to persons standing near, when suddenly he fell backwards and in an instant was dead. It always kind of reminds me of like one of those like Monty Python scenes. Like, you know, the guy's like talking and then all of a sudden he's like, oh, and just dead. Like this guy, like mid-sentence, just keeled over and died.
Okay. Monty Python was also not in my watching repertoire. I saw Spamalot once.
In August 1901, keeper Samuel Armoire became ill with typhoid fever after drinking contaminated water from the station's cistern. Yucky.
Ew.
Armoire's wife served as keeper until he recovered 3 months later. That has nothing to do with anything. I just thought it was a gross story, so I put it on.
That's why we had to hear about the skin book.
In 1991, archaeologist Karen Orwoski was working on the historic site preservation on Sheffield Island. One day, as she approached the island in a boat, she heard hypnotic and mystical music coming from the island with no source. She had also heard what seemed to be a foghorn where there was no foghorn and distant cries for help. Some believe the music could be attributed to the spirit of Captain Robert Sheffield, who played an unusual instrument called the longspell, similar to an oversized violin played with porcupine quills.
What?
Kind of cool, right?
The porcupine quills, do you think those are part of the bow, or do you think those are the strings on the violin itself?
The bow.
Yeah?
Or a plucker.
Like a guitar pick? But they use porcupine quills?
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
Have you ever seen someone like pluck at a harp weird?
No, the only time I've ever seen someone play a harp was on Big Bang Theory when Blossom would play the harp. Mm. But no, I've never seen somebody play a harp in real life.
It's phenomenal. Okay. Highly recommend. 10 out of 10. In fall of 1993, a tropical storm named
Beth.
Beth.
Wow, I got my own tropical storm.
That's why the story is here. In the fall of 1993, tropical storm named Beth sent waves crashing against the lighthouse foundation. Stones smashed through the basement window, and the basement was flooded with over 4 feet of water. A number of artifacts and furnishings were lost. A utility shed hosting the restored generator was knocked off its footing, and the generator was thrown into the water. The station's water cistern filled with seawater that had to be drained. The storm also significantly changed the shape of Sheffield Island.
Those darn Beths. They're always screwing everything up.
A real bee.
Yeah, well done.
There have been many paranormal experts who claim that the spirit of a young girl is trapped in the Sheffield Island lighthouse. The girl is believed to be the daughter of the keeper of the lighthouse, but no one knows which one. And I really apologize because I don't think I'm going to say this name properly, and I'm very sorry if she's listening. But Christine Krasinski?
Like John Krasinski?
No. Christine Koksinski.
Koksinski. Yeah. Ask Paul how to say it.
No, he's busy.
It sounds Russian-y.
It probably is, yeah. Or Polish or something. A paranormal investigator who founded Connecticut Paranormal Research and Investigations visited the Sheffield Island Lighthouse, and she claimed that the girl is named Abigail, and she is around 6 or 7 years old. Abigail is said to be bound to the island because of two adult ghosts who are wreaking havoc. Koksinski shared, "I have no idea who Abby may be. She is bound to the lighthouse, and she doesn't seem to be able to make her way out of there because of the two other spirits." We're just going to call her Christine. Christine further claimed that the farthest that Abigail can go is the beach, and she visits it sometimes. There are a lot of spirits on the island, and they were curious and interested in people. Orbs of light were following investigators, and there was one huge orb that kept following people. They like company and people coming out there. They seemed to be very peaceful, and the sense wasn't negative at all. It was welcoming, Christine said. The Seaport Association president, Thomas Kies, who, with some other board members, chaperoned the group to the island and said the night was perfect for ghost hunting. It was an interesting evening because it was a full moon between wispy, gauzy clouds and there was no wind. It was dead silent, said Kies. Kies also said he allowed the researchers to go about their business and said that the other board members huddled around a picnic table next to the lightkeeper's cottage that night. Away from the action, Kies said he did not see any ghosts or paranormal activity. And so as I was researching this, I found this website, sdparanormal.com. And on that site...
Sorry, SD?
Yes.
As in dog?
Yes.
Okay.
And they said that James Randi was actually notified of this case. So here's what I found out about that. James Randi, who many will know, is a professional... A professional magician and supernatural skeptic, said he wasn't the least bit impressed with the statement sent to him about Kaksky's visit to Sheffield Island. For years, Randy has offered a $1 million prize to anyone who could demonstrate any paranormal, supernatural, or occult power or event under test conditions agreed upon by both parties.
He also has two first names.
He does. Spooky. I get 10 or 11 of these things every day, said Randy, also known as the Amazing Randy, by telephone from his Fort Lauderdale, Florida office.
I just want to put out there, the only Amazing Randy is the Macho Man, Randy Savage.
Macho, macho, macho man. Okay. There is no sort of control on these sorts of things. These people are over-instrumented and have no skills handling the instruments, he said. When asked whether he believed in ghosts, Randy said he didn't know. Not having ever seen one, it makes me doubt it, he said. Randy said that researchers turn up their instruments so high that anything, a cell phone, doorbell, or any electrical device can create interference, which is then explained as a paranormal event. You can take one or two of these instruments anywhere you want, Central Park or a so-called haunted house, and if it's turned up high enough, it could react to almost anything, Randy said, explaining that electrical devices are always picking up interference. When your cell phone gets static or you hear a funny noise, you don't throw it down and say, "It's haunted," Randy said. So, you know, if you're familiar with the Amazing Randy, and you feel like me, which is he's kind of a smug guy. It's a little smug. I don't like smug. But that's what he had to say about it. He also said, and I don't know why it's not in here because I thought it was, but at one point he said that he wasn't like clear about how she got that name Abigail. And she said it just came to her intuitively.
I would have been a little bit more interested in the other two spirits she's referring to who are holding Abigail there.
I could not find any information, but I couldn't find a lot of information about the girl, but I found a lot of people who referenced the girl or said there was a girl. And what's very interesting about this is that there isn't a ton of information, but that they hold weekly haunted tours of the lighthouse.
Aha!
And you can you get on a boat and you go over, and I tried to look it up to see if we could go, but it's canceled now because of COVID.
Stupid COVID.
Maybe next August. They start in August.
Okay. That was a fun story.
Thanks.
I like when you find different experts who are talking about different things. Okay. Do you want to hear about my lighthouse?
Yeah.
A short boat ride off the end of Hull, Massachusetts will bring you to the United States' oldest lighthouse. Boston Light sits on a small island called Little Brewster, one of the many Brewster Islands that dot the vast spaces of Boston Harbor. At high tide, the entire island of Little Brewster is less than 1 acre, but it was determined by the American colonists to be an ideal place for a lighthouse to warn ships entering the harbor of the hazardous rocks and rocky shoals to be found. In 1717, a wooden lighthouse was built on the island, and almost immediately tragedy followed. The first lightkeeper, George Worthylake, I wanted to put in a joke here, something about maybe he should have stuck to lakes instead of oceans, but...
I was going to say the same thing.
Oh, good. So it wasn't as terrible a joke as I thought it was?
I'm known for bad jokes, so I don't know.
All right. Well, so George Worthylake was stationed there for a few short months with his wife, 5 children, an assistant lightkeeper, and several slaves. Since the island is so small and all goods and services had to be taken care of on the mainland, George had taken his wife and infant daughter to the city to attend church and to take care of some business. As they returned to the island on November 3rd, they dropped anchor a slight distance off the shore of Little Brewster, and one of the slaves, Shadwell, brought a canoe out to ferry them ashore. The canoe overturned, and all the people drowned. A replacement lightkeeper was assigned to the post, Robert Saunders. Within a week of his assignment, he also mysteriously drowned. During the Revolutionary War, which you may remember began here in Boston, the American Army repeatedly burned the lighthouse down so the British Army couldn't use it to help their ships navigate. In 1783, after the British were robustly defeated and kicked right off the continent, a new stone lighthouse was constructed, complete with a fog cannon. In 1851, the fog cannon was replaced with a 1,400-pound bell. In the late 1800s, a group of MIT scientists discovered what they call the Ghost Walk. The Ghost Walk is an area about 6 miles east of Boston Light where sound doesn't seem to travel or even penetrate. You can imagine this makes it difficult for ships to hear the fog bells when they're in that area. So the MIT scientists ran experiments testing out different kinds of bells, different frequencies, and a range of other ideas to see why sound wouldn't make it to the Ghost Walk. And do you know what they found?
No. A ghost?
That there was no answer about why sound doesn't travel in that spot.
Oh, that's very unusual.
So let me share another answer that exists about why there's no sound in this area. And this is from the Quonahasset Native Tribe here in Massachusetts. They believe that the area was, and still is, inhabited by a demon. We've actually talked about this demon on Ghost Hunting in New England before. It's Hobomok.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. That same demon that's been wreaking havoc on the Bridgewater Triangle is also causing shipwrecks in Boston Harbor. Boston Light is the only lighthouse in Massachusetts, or possibly the whole United States, to still have a live crew at the lighthouse 24/7. It's manned primarily by sailors from the Coast Guard station in Hull, but it's also upkept by volunteers. And there have been some spooky experiences there over the years. The first one is from 1947. Well, the first one I'm going to tell you about is from 1947. Maisie Anderson, the 22-year-old wife of the lighthouse keeper, reportedly heard footsteps behind her on the beach one afternoon while she was completely alone. As she tried to sleep at night, she was kept awake by what she described as a presence in her room. Another night, she heard what she called maniacal laughter coming from the boathouse. And yet another night, the laughter was coming from the fog bell house. Some nights, she would hear a young girl's voice crying and wailing, and then calling out, "Shadwell!" And Maisie had no idea until years later when she read about George Worthylake's experience that there was a slave who lived there named Shadwell.
Spooky.
In the late 1980s, Dennis Deaver was the Coast Guard petty officer assigned to the lighthouse, and he had some spooky experiences himself. He liked to tune his radio to rock and roll, and without warning, the radio would change itself to classical music. Now, this is the 1980s, so his radio had the old-style tuning knobs, not like the digital buttons that we have now. Somehow, the tuner was dialed all the way over to 102.5 WCRB. Now, I have to admit, I didn't actually get that particular detail from any of the works that I read. I actually had to just go into my own memory and think back to what was the classical music station in Boston forever, because, you know, Grandma and Papa would always have it on at their house, and my dad would listen to it constantly. So it was 102.5 WCRB. I think now 102.5 is a country station, maybe.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. Anyway, so back to Dennis Deaver. He also saw a man standing in the lantern room one day, except when he ran to the lantern room, there was no one there. And as he thought about it, he realized the man he had seen was wearing an old lightkeeper's uniform. Over the years, other people have reported cold spots, footsteps in the lighthouse when no one was there, rocking chairs that start rocking on their own, and Amelia, you'll love this. One person had a cat with them on the island, and the cat just became very agitated all the time and would randomly hiss at unseen somethings.
Oh, my cat does that.
Oh. In all the apartments you guys have lived in?
Mm-hmm. She doesn't do it in my new one as much.
As much?
Mm-mm. Almost never, actually.
Okay. I mean, my cats in the 4 years I've had them, I've never seen them randomly like get all upset and hiss at something not there.
Yeah, Liddy does stuff like that. She's a weird cat.
Okay, well. All right, so last I wanted to share this story from Coast Guard Compass. So this is about Joanne Levine Schroer. I think it's S-C-H-R-O-E-R. And she lived at Boston Light from 1948 until 1950, and this is the story that she tells. When we went out to the island, the second floor bedroom that faces the light itself was always locked. We had always heard that back in the 1800s, there was a light keeper whose wife went a little stir crazy and killed her husband right around Halloween, and then she wrote about it in her diary. Every October, we would hear these weird noises in that room. And one night, my mother jiggled the doorknob to see what was going on. All of a sudden, this black image came right through the door, down the hallway, and then down the stairs to the kitchen. It was the lightkeeper's wife, and she had a big dog with her. I woke up in the middle of the night, and there was that big dog sitting in the room. My dad was off the island on temporary assignment that night, so my mother frantically called the Coast Guard's sector headquarters in Boston for assistance. They sent a crew right out. They unbolted the door and opened it, and there were books all along the walls, but right in the middle of the room was a pedestal with the woman's diary on it, and it was opened to the night where she had killed her husband. The Coast Guardsmen took all of the books out of their room that night, and we never heard the strange noises again.
Spooky.
I know. And I have to admit, I really do love when I'm able to find these like first person accounts like this.
if you are interested in heading out to see Boston Light, it's actually under construction, so there's no tours at the moment, but you can take, there's a number of different ferries that go out into Boston Harbor. Some of them start from Boston, some of them start from Hingham, some of them start from Hull. And so you just take the ferry. I think it costs $35, and there's like a 2-hour tour. I think I read somewhere, actually, it was a 3-hour tour. It's an exciting 2-hour cruise to 3 iconic lighthouses. So it's $35 for adults, $30 if you're a student, senior, or military, $25 for kids, and if you're under 3, it's free. It's October, so the harbor parks are all closed down at this point. But if you wanted to go next summer, hopefully COVID-19 will not be as much of an issue anymore, and you can head out and see it. There's a bunch of other haunted islands out in Boston Harbor. And so I would love if they would put together like the haunted island boat tour. And if they would just focus on that, I would definitely take that tour in a second.
We should do it.
Do you have a boat?
No, but I have connections.
Okay. Well, let's find out more and we'll offer people boat rides.
I wonder how my dad has a canoe. Good story. That was funny. Good story. Okay, you want to hear my final story of the evening?
You have a bonus story?
I have another story, yeah.
Awesome.
All and right, it's getting anyway. Late, so we might skip mail this week because I'm like ready for bed.
I was ready for bed before we started.
Yeah.
the people need their ghost information.
Oh, I totally agree. But this is like the latest we've ever recorded. The Stratford Shoal Lighthouse. The Long Island Sound waterway along the New York and Connecticut borders contains one of the most treacherous waterways along the eastern seaboard. With many islands and reefs, lighthouses were needed to be built to aid mariners and shipping traffic from crashing on these rocky formations in the stormy weather. Stratford Shoal Lighthouse, often referred to as Middle Ground Lighthouse, is located on a rocky shoal roughly a mile in diameter, with most of it submerged 9 feet below mean sea level midway between Stratford Point in Connecticut and Long Island's Old Field Point in New York. Although initially the lighthouse was due to be completed around 1872, consistent severe weather delayed its completion until being lit in 1878 with 60-foot granite tower to withstand these dramatic conditions. Before the lighthouse was built, the ship Trustful was ready to set sail out of Bridgeport with a load of church bells as a major storm was approaching. As the storm drew closer, some of the crew started talking about staying on land and abandoning ship. The captain, who was notified of these events, told all crew members that if the ship sank, the bells would peal a dirge to the white-livered folk. And I like to think he says it kind of like a pirate, but I don't know how to do a good pirate accent.
But it's peal like, a dirge to the yeah. White River folk.
Yeah. Peel the dredge to the white-livered folk. No, that's like kind of like a bad Irish accent. I don't know. But it's just, it's a very like nautical thing to say. Okay. So the bells would peel a dredge to the white-livered folk who stayed behind. The crew.
A dredge or a dirge?
A dirge.
Peel a dirge to the white-livered folk.
Okay.
Aye, matey.
Aye. The crew reluctantly stayed aboard, and as almost a prophecy, the ship ran into the shoal and sank, drowning all crew members. Many mariners have claimed after that, when approaching the shoal in inclement weather, the muffled sound of church bells can be heard coming from below the waves.
Ooh.
Spooky. Due to its isolation, keepers of the Stratford Shoal Lighthouse sometimes would develop psychological issues. One such keeper was Julius Coster, the second assistant keeper, and the lighthouse rookie. In 1905, he was left behind with first assistant Merle Hughes, while the head keeper went ashore to gather supplies. There, Coster, who was a bit mentally unstable to begin with, got in an argument with Hulls and lunged at Hulls with a razor blade.
Bum, bum, bum.
Hulls was able to avoid being cut and persuaded Coster to put away the razor. A few days later, Coster locked himself in the lantern room with an axe. He then stopped the rotation of the light and threatened to smash it and kill himself. Once again, after hours of pleading, Hulls persuaded Coster to come out and talk to him. When Coster came out of the lantern room, he then decided to jump off the tower into the water. Hulls quickly dove in after and rescued him. Fearing for his safety and for Coster's as well, Hulls tied Coster up and kept him at the lighthouse tower for 2 days until help arrived. Just tied him up for 2 days.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he fed him and watered him and changed his bucket. Hopefully he gave him a bucket.
Coster was taken off the island and transported to a sanitarium in New York, where he ended up killing himself just a few days later. Although Coster did not perish at the lighthouse, many believe his spirit appears in the lighthouse throwing tantrums. Keepers and Coast Guardsmen have witnessed doors slamming in the middle of the night, chairs thrown against walls, and posters all ripped down. Hot pans of water have also been observed being flung onto the floor from the stove. Although the lighthouse was automated in 1969, local mariners going by the lighthouse still claim to hear lots of banging, grinding noises, and loud sounds as the ghost of Coster continues to cause trouble at the lighthouse.
The only thing scarier than a toddler having a tantrum is a ghost having a tantrum.
It's very spooky.
You know, a toddler will grow out of it. And also a toddler, you can like pick up and remove them from anything they can hurt themselves or you with. But yeah, a ghost like throwing like boiling water off the stove, that's frightening. Very frightening. I have information.
On what?
Richard Spencer. His first wife died in 1871. He remarried his second wife in 1877. She was born in 1852, so she was 25 when they got married. And he would have been 57.
That's so awesome.
And they were married for a long time.
Young, hot wife.
Mm-hmm. But that they were married for 43 years.
That doesn't mean anything. You're a young, hot wife.
I was when I got married.
You're still a young, hot wife. Oh, come on, Beth. Stop that. Don't talk about my friend Beth that way.
I'm wearing a flannel shirt and, like, mom jeans.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, do we have any new transition music this week?
Let's do the same as last week. And you know what, Beth?
What?
Last week, I said that that band was called Kings of the Boulevard. Well, apparently, I am a terrible daughter because the name of the band is actually the Boulevard Kings. And you can find them online at rockabillyband.net.
I have a lot of questions, but I feel like it's too late to start asking them.
So, that's very fair.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you all for listening, and thank you to everyone who sent stuff in. We'll read it next week.
So apparently you all have to come back next week.
Ooh, we got a good episode next week.
You can send us a message if you are unhappy that Amelia has decided not to read messages this week. You can email her at ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com. She also accepts shirtless pictures. The more creative, the better. You can find us on all the social medias. And if you don't know what they are by now, please listen to another episode where we tell you where they are there.
And feel free to send us a DM on Instagram, because that's what I feel like everyone's doing these days. Everyone's DMing us.
Yeah. Yeah. And rate, review, subscribe, 5 stars, 5 stars, 5 stars. And as always,
happy hunting.
Happy hunting.